And the question at the top of your sheets in the task book is, why bother? Why bother with being a Christian? Why bother being a Christian? Verse 58 calls it work and labour. I don't know, had you noticed that? Had you noticed that Christian service is hard? The Corinthians hadn't noticed. Their ministry is all about looking great and being the most spiritual and getting noticed. For them, life isn't hard. But most Christian ministry is hard work and looks unimpressive. You just heard Martin talking about the human feces. Most Christian ministry is like that. So let's ask the RML leaders. RML leaders, do you struggle as you're preparing your Bible study late at night after work when all you really want to do is sleep or relax in the pub with your mates? Do you struggle? Is that pitiful? Is that in vain? Is that worthless? I spent my first 3 years at St. Helens helping out with a lunchtime talk in Covent Garden and preaching at that regularly. And someone got us all organised after a while when I'd been there and put all the talks onto a computer and onto CDs, like our man there is into. Thank you, Mr. Vance. And he put them all onto CD, and my life's work weighs about 15 grams. There it is, that's my life's work. And they showed it to me and I said, is that all of my talks? So expecting the answer, no, and here are all the rest. And they said, no, quite a lot of those are by Simon Dowdy and Nigel Bynum. And you laugh, but where are your Bible studies? I have the CD. Yeah? And where are your Bible studies? Humanly speaking, it is all pitiful, isn't it? It's all pathetic. Why bother? Is it hard work, Christian ministry for students? When you've got a dissertation to write and exams to revise for and CVs to post, why should you bother trekking into the centre of town to go to a prayer meeting with your CU? Why should you bother? Loads of you had missions last term. I know GKT and QM, LSE had missions. And I hear stories about how hard you worked. Or at LSE, I was there to see it for myself. You asked friends to talks. You went on speaking to them about the gospel. You worked hard at it. How do you feel about the hard work now? A term on, maybe sort of tired, with very little to show from it, apart from some badly done work during those couple of weeks of term. Was it worth bothering? Was it worth bothering? Why bother? Corinth. Corinth is a church where they had decided not to bother anymore. And just sort of see what happened a year or two later on. And what happened was they argued and divided and ended up in court. They got drunk in church. They slept with prostitutes. And when they went out with their friends, there was no way to tell which were the Christians, even if you were in the pagan temples. And if you'd been Paul and reaching the climax of your letter, wouldn't you have delivered the most terrifying telling off to a church like that? You godless, stinking, immoral, idolatrous, hypocritical, mindless. But Paul is their pastor, not their judge. And Paul sees the real reason of why they've stopped bothering. They've stopped bothering because they've lost any reason to do Christian stuff if it costs. If it costs effort or status or discomfort. And he gets to the climax of his letter, chapter 15, and he tells them why to bother. Just look at verse 58 again. We've been there several nights. Verse 58. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immobile, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labour is not in vain. Don't move, don't give up. Give yourself fully, abound in working for the Lord, because you know your labour is not in vain. There's our theme word again. It's not in vain. And why not in vain? Why bother? And we started this last night. And last night's answer was bother because there are real bodies waiting for you in the new creation. And tonight, I think what tonight adds is the bodies that are waiting for you are not just real and physical, but they are better. They are perfect bodies compared to the ones you have now. See our verses, we're doing 35 to 49 tonight, and they're all about those bodies. Paul starts with one of their main objections, verse 35. It sort of came up in the question time today. Verse 35, what kind of body, with what kind of body do they come? And Paul answers by pointing to Jesus again. The basic answer is we will have bodies. What kind of bodies? We'll have bodies like Jesus' body. after the resurrection. So follow it down. Verse 35 looks like a good question. See, Paul says that dead people get up out of their graves and begin to live again with bodies and teeth and hair and toenails. And can you hear the mockery behind verse 35? Okay, Paul, how old will we be? Will six-month-old babies who die, will they crawl and dribble for eternity? Or will laughter lines and sort of distinguished grey hair, will they vanish along with sciatica and cancer so that we'll all look like identical Topshop models, so walking around heaven? We could add the question from this lunchtime, what if one of my molecules is one that used to be part of Paul 2,000 years ago? Who has first claim on it, like we said? And Paul's answer is, we will have bodies like Jesus' resurrection body. Our section finishes in verse 49, saying exactly what verse 22 got us ready for. Our new bodies will be the likeness, bear the image of Jesus, just like the bodies now are the image of Adam. So think about the resurrection appearances of Jesus that we looked at on the first night from verses 1 to 11. When Jesus appears after his death, he is really Jesus. He has wounds in his hands. He is the same man talking to the same friends. The relationships go on. But there are also major differences. Not being dead is just the beginning of what has changed about Jesus with his resurrection. He's now indestructible. He's transformed into a new sort of being alive. He can appear and disappear at will. He can be recognized or not as he wishes. Now, given that they believe that Jesus has been transformed into a whole new way of being alive, given they believe that, is it really so difficult to think that we'll be changed like that as well? So that's where Paul goes. So follow it down the notes. Verses 35 to 41 is all from the GCSE science textbook. So Paul starts giving them a bit of a slap. You foolish person, what you sow doesn't come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare seed, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. It's just basic biology. Here we go. This is complicated. Non-scientists, hold on to your seat. Basic biology. Seeds and plants look very different. Okay, is that all right? Is that okay so far? And that's it. Seeds and plants look very they are different. The seeds aren't really anything until you put them in the ground and they break apart, they die, and you get the plant. Verse 42 says that our bodies now are just like seeds. We sow them. That's what death is. You're sowing your this body. They're just like seeds compared to the new bodies we will have. And the lesson from basic biology is we are used to a God, an amazing God who runs his world to bring about amazing transformations. It'd be crazy to argue backwards from what seeds are like to deny that plants exist. I just can't see it. Just because seeds just rattle around. There can't be plants. I don't believe it. There is a difference between a little tiny seed and the enormous, tall, prickly branch, totally camouflaged in the darkness tree that we all ran into during the wide game. There is a difference. Running into the seed, that would not have hurt. The plant is different. That's all it is. Ever since we first grew cress on soggy cotton wool in primary school, we've been happy with that bit of basic biology. Seeds turn into plants. And the God who is able to superintend the science that brings 70-foot trees out of tiny seeds, he is able to take your dead body and make something very different. Verse 42. So it will be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. You're right. It'd be stupid to think of bodies like this living forever. That'd be ridiculous. Just like it's stupid to think you could hang tinsel and baubles on a Christmas tree seed. Do they even have seeds? What do they have? Fir cone things. But there's seeds inside, aren't there? Yeah, there you go. Seeds. You sow a body like this, it dies, and God the creator of the universe with seeds and plants in, raises a body that is imperishable. Just like with Jesus, there's an old body and a new body. They're related, the two bodies. We said this in question time as well. You can still see the wounds on Jesus' hands. There is a relationship between the big Roman thug who stuck a nail in Jesus' hand and the body that Jesus now has. Fir trees are related to the seeds they come from. But Jesus' body is very, very different. There is continuity and there is difference. And while Paul has the GCSE biology textbook open, he points to the next page on it. He just says, look at everything God made. So verses 39 to 41, they read like a recap of Genesis 1, don't they? Here's again, Saatchi's big story of the Bible. Just look down at it. God made humans and animals and birds and fish. And also verse 41, the sun, the moon and the stars. We're in Genesis 1. We're just looking at what God the Creator made. And the point here is God is aware that they are all different. God knows that he has experience of putting the right thing in the right place. He's good at that. Verse 40, heavenly things like stars and planets. The Creator knows they are different from earthly things like ants and frogs. Not once has God brought to life a frog in the deep outer reaches of space when he was meant to be making a black hole or a big star. Never once has God done that to a frog. So ribbit. Never once. So yeah, we will need very different bodies to be in the new creation if Christians are all to be raised. But the God who made everything, he has that in hand. And the GCSE science textbook actually needs a whole new chapter, verses 42 to 44. Whole new chapter. You should be able to flick in your science textbook past insects and fish and amphibians and mammals and spiders, who quite rightly have no friends. They need their own chapter. Spiders, no one wants to be with them. And then after all those chapters, there should be a chapter for new bodies, made for new people, appropriate for the new creation. Now, I don't suggest you try asking your biochemistry lecturer that, why their course has been so incomplete. But there should be that chapter, because all science is observation of the world that exists. And in this world, Jesus rose. In the real scientific world, he was seen and he was touched and caused effects that are still echoing around this world here today, our real physical universe. There should be a chapter on this kind of body. It exists. Your biology textbook is incomplete without it. The kind of body that Christians will have. And if 35 to 41 illustrate why it isn't silly to believe there could be new kinds of bodies, 45 to 49 prove that it really will happen. It's very like what we said yesterday. So God the Creator is making a new creation. It's that big a deal, with a new Adam and a new race of people who will have the kind of bodies this new Adam has. So verse 45, just turn to that. We'll need to look at this in some detail. Verse 45 quotes from Genesis chapter 2. It says, Adam became, the first man Adam, became a living being. Or literally, just look at the footnote, we'll need this. Look down at the footnote, a living being, or literally a living soul in the Greek. So that's what happened on creation day. Adam became a living soul. But Jesus is way beyond that. He's the last Adam, and he became a life-giving spirit. So this verse takes us right back to the dramatic moment in the creation story. It's so dramatic, Louis needs to tell someone about it on the other side of the world. There we go. The dramatic moment in the creation story, where God made a human shape from dust and laid the human shape out on the ground. And then the Creator God breathed into his nostrils, and Adam lived, became a living being, a living soul. And verse 45 says there has been a sequel in God's creative work. Jesus' body was laid out on the ground, and God has acted there too. Not to return Jesus to the kind of body he had before. No. The resurrection does far more than that. Jesus is spirit where Adam is soul. Jesus is spirit where Adam was soul. Jesus can give life to all those who are in him. That's what we said last night. He is the life-giving spirit. He sends his spirit to give life. He is completely different from Adam. As different as earth and dust are from heaven, these verses say. And verse 49, just like every human being has borne the image of Adam, we have Adam bodies, living souls, so every Christian in the new creation will bear the image of Jesus. So point 3, verses 45 to 49, that is true because new creation equals new Adam equals new bodies. And the force of these verses, you'll have heard it as we had it read, are the differences that Paul keeps piling up, the contrasts. I put them in the box at the bottom of the sheet, the pile of contrasts. That is the content. If anyone wants to write that chapter in the biology book, this is the content of that chapter. What is this new body like? And there are just lots of contrasts to it: perishable, imperishable, dishonor, glory, weakness, power. Greek culture in Corinth despised bodies, and in a sense, rightly. I think our culture worships bodies maybe too much. They despised bodies. Bodies are weak, falling apart, dishonorable. And Paul says, yeah, that's right, these bodies are, they're like that. But God's answer to that isn't something less physical, with clouds and floating and shining lights. God's answer is something more physical. Look at the third line in the list of contrast. This body is sown in weakness, yeah, that's right, but it is raised in power. That's what the new body will be like. So unlike this weak body, it'll be a body of power. So this is for all the guys who spend their time pumping iron. We had a little chat on one of our tables on the first night, and everybody on the table denied that they did this. And I reckon about half of them were lying, I think, particularly him, I think. For all of you guys who pump iron, so if you're aiming for one of those bodies on the front cover of Men's Health, okay, the guys with muscles on top of muscles that most people don't normally have, if you're aiming for them, those guys, even those guys, weaklings, compared to the body that Christians will get in the new creation, which instead of a weak body like this will be a body of power. You don't only live once, you live twice, and your new body will be better. I'm not sure actually it's so different for girls. Body image, I think, is still massive for girls as well as for boys. What sort of body do you want? I don't know, does it bother your friends? Girls don't have this sort of conversation with me. But does it bother your friends, surprisingly? Does it bother your friends that at age, I don't know, 20, 21, do they say things like, I'm the most beautiful I ever will be? Does that bother your friends? This is it. From here on, you're getting older. I don't know if that, does that bother you? Maybe it does. Suddenly it does. It shouldn't bother you because of the new bodies to come. These bodies will get old and fall apart. But your new body is imperishable and glorious. You don't only live once, you live twice with better bodies. That's what this chapter is saying. Look at the contrast in verse 44. That is the central contrast. Verse 44, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. It's the contrast I've put at the head of my two lists. That's the one in bold at the top of the two lists. But you see, I've not gone with natural and spiritual. Someone asked the question earlier today, not in the question time, someone asked me whether I was going to cover it tonight. See, some people looked at that verse, natural body versus spiritual body, and they've used it to undo everything else that Paul has said in the rest of the chapter. They've gone, aha, natural bodies and spiritual bodies, obviously. That means physical bodies being replaced with non-physical ones, made of spirit. And suddenly we're back to the floaty future that Paul has been trying to knock down the whole time. Now, not only does that not fit with everything else Paul's been saying in the chapter, but also it doesn't fit the words here. In Paul's Greek, when Greek wrote the first word, the first word comes from soul, and the second word comes from spirit. Now, Nick has a Greek exam on Monday, is that right? Wednesday. Do you know the word for soul? Do you know the word for spirit? It's very serious. It's a shame. One of those words, the reason I put it how I have, one of those words is soulish, psyche. That's the word for soul. Okay, so psychikos, a psychic-y body. And the word for spirit is pneuma. It's from pneumatic, that sort of thing. Is a pneumatikos body. So one is a soulish body, one is a spirit-ish body. That's what, like in verse 45, it's the same contrast, isn't it? Adam is a living soul, and Jesus is a life-giving spirit. So verse 45 reads, it is sown a soulish body like this one. It is raised a spiritish body like Jesus is. And if Paul had wanted to pull his whole argument to pieces and go back to talking about non-physical spirit bodies, the last word he would have used is soulish for the old body. The soul is the bit that in Corinth they thought went on living forever. The last thing he would have said is that this body is the soul-y one, if he'd wanted to undo it. So soulish body and spiritish body. They're not about what the bodies are made of, like this body's made of soul, the new body's made of spirit. It's about what drives them. It's a bit like the Daleks. Okay, so a Dalek is driven, is directed by the little Khaled who sits inside, the sort of slimy thing driving the body. Except that our bodies are far more than a sort of mobility chair, for souls. It's also a bit like talking about where the power and the energy comes from. We are soul-driven. In this sense, a sailing ship is windish, driven by the wind. That's where the power comes from. Our new bodies now are driven by souls. Our bodies now are driven by souls. The new body is powered by the Spirit of God, is spiritish, driven, directed, powered by the Spirit. So did you get the point? It's the same as the whole chapter. This is really, really real, these verses are saying. We're in the same science lab as trees and stars when we talk about this new body. Jesus is testable, new body. So let's just enjoy the contrast for a bit. Just chew the first one on the list round for a second. Perishable versus imperishable. These bodies are perishable. I don't know if that is something that ever bothers you. My favourite driving story in the papers recently was about driving tests for the over 70s, which some people think is a good idea. And the story came with a photo of an old man who reversed his VW Polo all the way up the bonnet of a Ford Galaxy. And he didn't stop until he'd made it onto the roof and his wheels were stuck on the windscreen. The interview with him, he said, I didn't notice the car behind. And there's a photo, so it must be true. The car's at a 40 degree angle and the driver's seat is now 4 feet off the ground. Now, it's a comedy story, isn't it? You know, funny old man, what he did. But growing old is not funny at all, is it? It's horrible. I won't talk you through my family's experiences of what it's like. We all know it. Eyes going, strength weakened, brains confused. What kind of body will we have? Not this one. Not a body like this. We will have new bodies, like Jesus' body. We'll be imperishable. We won't get old. We won't break. Adam's sin and God's punishment means that dust keeps returning to dust, ashes to ashes. Jesus' resurrection gives life. Spiritish bodies, glorious, powerful, imperishable. You don't have to be old to think that that sounds achingly wonderful, do you? So why bother? Why bother? Why does that make any difference? The Corinthians stopped bothering because they were only looking forward to a new soul, not a new body. But you will have new bodies, and all the things you want for your body now, if you miss out on some of them, that is not in vain. You will have better bodies. It would be very hard, wouldn't it, to give up any of being young, free and single if this life is the only crack at it that you have. But this body is just the seed of something far realer. Like Martin said, when in the middle of some labour for the Lord, that in the sort of face of it is horrible, lift the eyes, see what is really real. This body is just the beginning. RML leaders, you can leave. You can keep working at your Bible studies. It is not in vain. Students, you can leave the dissertation on your desk and come in for the CU prayer meeting. It's not in vain. Now, all of us will have separate areas where the labour and work of the Lord runs up against things that my body really wants, things that you want to keep for this body and this life for myself. What I'm going to do now is do a few examples, two example areas that are deliberately, I hope, some of you may be deciding, one of them is going to be careers, some of you may have to decide that this week, like Martin did, but a kind of a design not to be the issue you're definitely wrestling with right now. I'm going to do two example issues, both quite big issues, and then hopefully that is so that you can have a go on your own at whatever are the big issues for you. The places where your body wants you to keep for itself, doesn't want to miss out on things now, because you haven't twigged, you've got a second life to come. So start with future decision about career. I can see, if you only had one life, I can see why you would want and need a well-paid career and a nice house and a happy family, or why you'd want a sort of public recognition that your life is valuable. You'd want the job that makes people say that. But you don't only live once. You live twice. You have a second life. So if you have two lives, you can spend every day in this life fully given to the work of the Lord. Now, I don't think that all Christendom should leave their jobs and go and do Christian work. I don't think that. But actually, nor am I. I'm not speaking to all of Christendom here, am I? I'm not speaking to sort of standard average range of the normal population. I'm speaking to a very select group. I'm speaking to some of the most able students in the world who study at universities where thousands of people travel thousands of miles and pay thousands of pounds a term and compete and study to be doing the degrees that you're doing at the universities that you're doing. And lots of those sort of people go on to run whole countries. That's the group that we have here. And also you're the group who lap up Bible teaching, who agree to come on things like Task, who buy books from Gwilym's store and do well at Bible Unwrapped. So let me ask a controversial question. Why is it that only 10-15% of St. Helens students end up in full-time Christian work? Why not 70%, given the people that you are as a range of the population of Britain? Now, I know there'll be some people here that won't be right for. Some of you will only recently become Christians. You'll need to wait for a couple of years to grow as a Christian, see if that'd be right for you. Some of you as well might have a particular battle with a sin that would be a scandal to the gospel if you were going to go into Christian work. It'd be a danger to do that. Well, okay, you need to pray urgently to be released from that sin so that you can serve. But I guess for lots and lots of people here, it may actually be something Corinthian that holds you back. It may be something to do with not wanting to give up this life. The kicker for me is that even our excuses, even our sort of good godly reason, can be quite Corinthian, actually. I think, so some people will say to me, quite often people at St. Helens say to me, I couldn't do full-time Christian work because I'm not good enough. I wouldn't be good enough at it. I think actually we have a particular St. Helens problem with that. So some people look at William Taylor and say, I have to wait until I be as good at ministry as William Taylor. And so that gets me off the hook. But I think, it sounds very humble, doesn't it, to say it like that? But I think actually it's part of a London thing with excellence. You see, you could choose a career. You could go on and be a chemist, or you could go and be a management consultant. And chances are people like you would be at the very top of your field. You'd be some of the best people in the world at what you do. And if you're playing that against a career where, as a Bible teacher, you'd be faithful and useful, but you'd be middle of the road, can you see the Corinthian thing, even in the sort of excuse that says, I'm not good enough? I guess that is why London students who are better prepared for ministry than whole dioceses or cities in some parts of the world don't go into full-time ministry. If you really think you aren't up to it, then I give you permission right now to skip Task tomorrow morning. We'll arrange a lift for you. You can pick any village you like on the map around here and go to church there. I know nothing about the churches here. I'm just confident enough in the state of churches in this country in general to reckon chances are you'd hit one that would make my point. I reckon most of them will be like the churches I knew in Somerset where I grew up. Most of the ministers working there will be like my dad as a vicar when he was alive, trying really hard to help people, but without the background in the Bible that you guys have. And having been trained at Bible college, being told that the Bible isn't the word of God and isn't the way that you help people. Churches around here, they've probably never even heard of a youth worker or a women's worker. Graduates from London could go through the churches of Britain like dynamite. Nearly every one of you could do better. Get in the car and we'll do it. Or we could do it next weekend. Sunday morning, we'll drive out somewhere. Your body can get the career buzz in the new creation. The house, the holiday, the hobby, there will be time to do that. But you have this spare life now. What will you spend it doing? That's career. How about money? Let's do that as the second one. So we had a seminar about money yesterday. I don't want to repeat it. It is a genuinely complicated issue. I know that. It's also one that British people are embarrassed talking about. But here is a general observation. At St. Helens. St. Helens is a church made up very largely of recent graduates. It's where people like you from across the country often end up. And many of them, most of them, are very keen, well-taught Christians, devoted to Jesus Christ. But I'd say money is probably an area where lots of them struggle. And I think part of that is to do with thinking and decisions they made as students. So let me ask you, as non-combatants, so students only, let me ask you, as non-combatants, without wages, what you reckon at St. Helens on a Sunday night, what you reckon the average normal giving of someone who wasn't a student would be per year? What do you reckon the sort of normal giving would be? It's like a dangerous question to ask. £1,000, guess over here. Other guesses? What do people think? 500. Other guesses?
200, including like foreign banks. In total, I reckon the average person gives about 300.
3 grand a year. See, everything they give, to St. Helens. Yeah, 3 grand.
200.
Okay, interesting. Okay, some of you are more depressing than me. That's interesting. So 1,000. 1,000 is the right answer. That's the right answer. £1,000 a year. That's the average thing. And it sounds like a huge amount of money, maybe, to a student. And it is. And to some of those people, it is a huge amount of money. Struggling with London rent and London travel to jobs and setting up home in London, a huge amount of money. But then you think some of them are the highest paid graduates in the country. Some of them are the highest paid people in the country, in the top sort of 0.something%. I don't want to judge any individual person, certainly not the workers who are here, giving up their weekend, taking a day off work to be here. I don't know any individual situation. The clergy, it sounds, work really carefully to make sure we don't know what any individual gives. We're nothing to do with it, nowhere near it. But as an average, it says to me probably people aren't giving as if this body will be replaced by something better in the future. And I think if you don't begin in small ways as a student, making that kind of, I can deny this body something now because I have a body in the future, I don't think it suddenly changes when you get a job and a salary and suddenly becomes easier. So let me tell you about some money heroes of mine, some money heroes. I know of a young city worker who deliberately runs a far worse car than he could otherwise afford. It's something of a disgrace, so he turns up with his colleagues. They're all there in their Aston Martins or whatever, and he rocks up in his battered old thing. But the money that he's saving, he is using to fund gospel work in some places he really cares about, feels strongly about. Now, he will have a new body with sharper reflexes and better eyesight, better control of the accelerator pedal, or whatever it is you'll do in the new creation. I don't know the details. But he will have an eternity to drive around the new creation in a better body, doing things that are more fun. He can afford to give up the car now. Or I know another guy who is higher up the city pecking order. He's not quite a master of the universe, but he's sort of close. Maybe he's sort of battle cat, if that means anything to anyone. He's pretty high up in the thing. And before he became a Christian, he did what everyone else did. He always went on holiday to Thailand or somewhere like that, spent 2 weeks in a top hotel. That was his holiday, just like everyone else did. But when he became a Christian, he told them that's not what he was going to do this year. This year he was going to come and wash toilets on a camp, just like the camps we were telling you about on the first night. I don't mean to do down the sacrifice that it is when a student comes and helps out on camp. It's a huge sacrifice. You give it a load of your holiday, do a load of things that are amazingly important. I think you're amazing. But when this guy said that, people sort of expect students to do crazy things. But this guy, he's a proper grown-up. The rest of the team on the camp, they called him Grandad or Week. He could afford to do anything in the world with that week. He could afford to just think anything you'd like to do. He could have afforded to do anything he wanted with that week. But the labor of the Lord is not in vain. He will have a better body in the new creation, and there will be time for a few holidays in the new creation. There will be time. As it happens, though, and I love this. I love this about the way the Lord works. We think we're making a huge sacrifice. We think we're going to have a horrible time and wonder how we're going to survive. But actually, in the middle of it, you suddenly find you're in the place of greatest joy. So he, at the end of camp, he said to me, "This is the best holiday I've ever had." This is a man who has spent his life road testing the most glamorous locations in the world to have a holiday. "This is the best holiday I've ever had. This is the only place I've ever been where I could actually forget about work." Isn't that interesting? Isn't it interesting? Now, we had the question earlier, don't we, about whether you're allowed to enjoy your life. Absolutely you are. Absolutely you're allowed to do things that your body wants. But also, an amazing thing about the Lord is that as I give up things and die every day, I find joy in the things I've given up in the sacrifice. Even joy in suffering, Paul says. Someone who knows far more about suffering than any of us. Amazing. Or another hero, Mr. Lang. Have you heard of Lang Construction? So as you walk around London, chances are lots of the big buildings and big cranes owned by Lang Construction. Mr. Lang lived and died a Christian. And when his company that he started to do well, he made, first of all, he made all the sort of sensible financial decisions. He bought a house, made sure he'd looked after his family's needs and security. He did all of that. And then a bit like Ash was encouraging us to do in the seminar on money, he worked out how much he needed to live on. To live comfortably, he didn't wear hair shirts, any of that. Live comfortably, happily, enjoying what God had given him gratefully, but not lavishly and wastefully either. He worked that out, and then he decided to only spend that equivalent amount on himself for the rest of his life, no matter what he earned after that. So he made that decision early on in his career. And the way he did, he was quite sensible. He said, what I'll do after that level, I will save half of what I earn that's more than that and give half of what I earn above that away. And he did that for a bit, but after a few years, the business had done well, and he found that his savings alone were big enough to generate the income that he decided on. The stuff he got saved could do that. So from then on, he gave everything he earned away because he pegged a sort of like, this is what my body needs to survive. This is what we need as a family to be sensible, provided for. Everything above that, he gives away. I heard about breakfast recently for City Business People. I know Sam was there, weren't you? Where Thomas is right, I heard the story. One of the City people speaking, he turned to 1 Kings 18, verse 4. This might be hermeneutical terrorism. I'm not sure. I don't actually think so. In 1 Kings 18, verse 4, there is a guy called Obadiah who works for the king. He works for a very bad king, one of the bad kings that we were learning about this morning. And the bad king has decided to kill all the prophets of the Lord. And Obadiah is an important guy, a rich guy. Obadiah takes 100 prophets and hides them in a cave and feeds them and waters them, keeps them alive, and fed them through the whole persecution. This city guy stood up. I didn't see him, don't know who he is, but I can sort of imagine the city suit, the squared shoulders. He said, all right, ladies and gentlemen. Do you speak like that? No. Okay. He said, we're all about financial benchmarking. That's what our lives are about. Well, there is your benchmark, Obadiah. Could you support 100 people in gospel work? Could you do it? Or where are you on the benchmark? Are you 50% of an Obadiah? Could you support 50 people? Or start with one. Start with one. Think support one gospel work. Wouldn't it be brilliant? I think that's an amazing thing to say at that sort of breakfast. Wouldn't it be brilliant to be able to say, the Lord has given me all this money, and because I don't need this body to get the best of everything necessarily, the most expensive of everything, and there is a gospel work happening somewhere in the country because my body didn't need all those things. It's happening and it wouldn't have happened otherwise. I've paid for it. Or 100 gospel workers that are still alive in a persecuted country because I paid for that to happen. Wouldn't that be amazing? A whole country's church, 100 pastors, be pretty significant in a Muslim country or somewhere like that. Wouldn't that be amazing? You'd need to really believe in better bodies, wouldn't you, to support 100 gospel workers. Just think how much nicer your house could be if you hadn't wasted all your money giving sweaty gospel workers houses, which they probably fill with bad wallpaper and cheesy Christian posters. Just think how nice your house could be. You'd have to really believe in new bodies and better bodies in the future. You don't only live once. You live twice. One life that lasts forever in perfect, glorious, imperishable bodies. And one life to spend here in the labour and work of the Lord. Now, I suggest just take 4 or 5 minutes, I suggest now, and just maybe make a list of the issues you might want to think about later. It's just maybe on your piece of paper, maybe a list of some of the things you've given up already, maybe you feel quite sore about. And get ready to write next to them, was this in vain or not? Will I be able to do this with my new body? So whatever that would be for you, whether it's giving up some time to do work to come to the CU prayer meeting, whether it's giving up some time with friends to come to RML, whatever it is that at the moment is the thing niggling you. And then make a list maybe of your current decisions. So things you're trying to decide whether you've got time to do. So next term is the term when CU start asking people whether they could help lead their CU next term, which is a load of hassle. Ask any of the people, the blokes and girls who are doing it this year. Load of hassle. Would it be worth it? Would that be in vain? There's a decision you might have to make. And maybe a list of future resolutions as well. Like Mr. Lang. Resolutions about your time, resolutions about your money. Now is the best time to make resolutions like that. Before the pay packet is coming in and the spending is going out the other way. Now's the best time to make those resolutions. I suggest we take 4 or 5 minutes. I'll then come back up and pray. And then I think, Cara, we've got one more song, haven't we? Yeah. So just take a few minutes on your own.